tonight we're going to dig into some stuff. As I mentioned last night, we're looking at the picture of the Old Testament from a couple of different ways. And I gave a couple of brief illustrations of this idea so we can quickly capture the concept. I'm going to do that again in 1 second, remind us of those principles. But I also want to point something out. As we get deeper into our pathway from Genesis to Jesus, we're going to begin to see some really amazing things. But unfortunately, we can't cover all of them because we only got 7 scriptures, 7 nights. So there's going to be a little bit of these sections where I'm going to story tell parts of the history of Israel. When I do that, here's something I would love for everyone to try to do. It's a challenge at time to do this, but make a little bit of a pretend zone. And what you need to do is pretend that you're sitting on the bank of the Jordan River and your grandfather is telling you the stories of Israel. I say that because the Old Testament, in many ways, is written that way. It is written as narratives. It is not a history book. It's not a science book. It's written to tell us things, to motivate us about ideas and people, people that aren't just random folks pulled out of history. These are family, especially when we talk about Israel as a nation. When you mention Joseph or you mention Isaac or you mention Moses, these individuals invoke great emotion. Great mystery and great possibilities. So as we go through both the storytelling sections that are in between each of these passages and the individual signposts, because that's kind of what these scriptures are. Again, picture yourself listening to, say, your grandfather telling you about the good old days of Israel and trying to teach something to you, to me, and to all of us. Last night we talked about creation. Tonight, we're going to talk about Abraham. Tomorrow is going to be a really exciting lesson where we look at Exodus. And there's an amazing portion of the history of Israel that is in conflict with Egypt. Egypt is a big part of the Old Testament. And the conflict there, by the way, is not just a physical conflict. It's not just the people of Israel crossing over the Red Sea or the Reed Sea. That's not the big story in some ways. The big story is the giant heavens that are in conflict with the majesty of God and the conflict between the deities of Egypt and the Elohim, the God, and the God who created all things, the Elohim singular, which is the Father or Yahweh. That conflict is shown in a physical way in Exodus. And from Exodus, we'll go to David. And from David, we'll talk about the prophets. And then on Saturday night, we're going to see how the Old Testament does that thing I mentioned about the conflict or the misunderstanding in a Hallmark movie where there is this, I know what should happen next moment. Well, that's going to happen again when we talk about the gospel from Isaiah 52. And then Sunday evening, we'll close out looking at some of the Psalms and wisdom literature, talking about one of the most powerful Psalms that make its way into not just biblical culture, but the cultures of most of our probably family experiences. We talk about the Lord as my shepherd in Psalm 23. And if I didn't catch that detail when I hinted that Hallmark moment, I want to go over it real quickly, not as long as we did last time, but a little shorter. The Hallmark movie is an American cultural phenomenon of some kind because it's been around all my life, and they have a very stable structure. And at some point in that movie, there is a misunderstanding from the two people that are the main participants, and then that gets resolved, and everything's great afterwards. But you're always looking for it, and you're always wanting it. And once it happens, there's a sense of satisfaction. Well, in the Bible, there are pictures just like that. There are events just like that, that when they happen, you immediately see it a second time. And I'm going to give you another one. Last night, I showed you a biblical idea that talks about how whenever a patriarch goes to a well, he finds a wife. A hint for gentlemen out there, if you're looking for a wife, apparently you go to wells. That's where you find them if you're finding the good wives. But for us, let's talk about another one. This one's really powerful. It won't be part of our series, but it's one you'll probably recognize. In the Old Testament, we see in the Sinai events, when Moses has Israel on the other side of the Reed Sea and they're making their way wandering towards Israel, they're going to bounce off eventually, but before that happens, Moses goes to the mountain, or Moses goes up on the mount. When that happens, God delivers a law that is a law for their new relationship to God, their newness in a kingdom they didn't know ahead of time, and becomes part of the picture. And actually, there's about 20 instances in the Old Testament where Moses going to the mount is like a grammatical phrase. It appears in Hebrew, and for our purposes right now, it's in the Septuagint, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament text. That exact wording for Moses going to the mount appears in the Gospels, and specifically when Jesus goes to the mount. If you remember the Sermon on the Mount, he gives them a new law, a new kingdom, and a great gospel. And so when you see Jesus going to the mount, you should then immediately expect God's going to do something great here. I better pay attention. And because you're a Israelite now listening to his father's or grandfather telling him the stories of Israel, you pay more close attention, just like we would with the gospels and just like we would in other circumstances. So now you've got two biblical illustrations that tie to that same idea of the misunderstanding of Hallmark movies. And now everyone's going to maybe reframe their thinking of Hallmark movies, but maybe it will also reframe your thinking about how the Bible works and how God is trying to teach us through these powerful stories that, like songs, get stuck in our head. They just reside there and won't go away. And if you've had kids and your kids were raised in America, if I started talking about Wheels on a Bus, you'd probably be upset with me right now, because that song might start going round and round in your head until it wouldn't leave again. Well, now let's turn our Bibles and pay attention to what takes place in another passage in the text of Genesis, chapter 12 and verse 3. In a moment, I'll put some fancy scriptures and stuff on the screen, but we're not there just yet. In Genesis 12 and verse 3, the scripture reads this way: I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. You may know in the text of Genesis that there's really two halves to the book. There is Genesis 1 through 7 and then 12 through the rest. And things change a lot. Things change a lot when someone comes on the scene that begins to shift the picture. Because you remember, we closed our look at Genesis 1 and 2 with a focus on Genesis 1:1, understanding that there was an unresolved problem. You may remember that God, in the outcome of Eve and then Adam's rebellion and the conflict with the serpent, he had expelled them from the Garden of Eden, that place where those of the earth, Adam, man, could meet with those of the heaven, God, in the Garden of Eden. It couldn't be there anymore. And you and I are now living in the consequential world of that experience. We deal with the consequences of Adam and Eve every day. If you read Genesis 1, 2, and 3 through today, maybe some last night, you may have noticed those balanced curses that are given to man and women that emphasize those differences of their rebellion, but then structure the world that we live in. But I want to add one more point to that. Pay attention to the text as well, that the ground in Genesis 1 and now in 11 and 12 is identified in and of itself as being cursed. It's not just that the work of men is harder in tending the creation or the temple, but it's that God cursed the ground itself. And we see that. Pay attention to this. If you think in your heads for a moment, you're listening to that story of, let's say, Israel, a little bit forward in history, and the way the blessed land of the promised land responds to God's great covenant. It pours forth goodness to them. It's not like it was before. If they follow the covenant, it will provide for them, not just in a little bit, an abundance. The picture that comes back with the spies that go out into Israel is they're carrying grapes so heavy and so massive and so tremendously different that the pole that it's on is bending because of its great weight, because God had blessed the land. And that land is a land that is very responsive to weather and circumstances even to this day. And we see that play out in their lives, that when the land is for them, that region and that area is abundant with growth, is abundant with wonderment. Now, with that picture of the land itself being cursed as well, pay attention to what we can consider for right now the early or first gospel. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, the Bible reads, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." That is the chain that ties our purposes together from the lesson last night to tonight's lesson, from Genesis 1:1 to Genesis and chapter 12. Because there's something being fulfilled from this component that's found in that text. Let me go ahead right now. We're going to open this up once I click all the right buttons. So I need another technician to actually be in the room here with me. I just have to import Cameron here to do all this. I don't know. We'll figure it out. There we go. I think we're all up and everything's good now. And if something's wrong, Cameron, you can give me the opposite Greco-Roman thumb and go down on it and up if everything's good. Or one way or the other, maybe middle ground. But here in this text, we're beginning to see what this means in a practical sense. Because remember, it said, "I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." This is a pledge that's being made. This is a picture that's being revealed. This is a concept and an idea that the very soon plan of God will start having that first blinking light of possibilities. In Genesis chapter 11, which leads into this, that's the story of Babel. In that context, there is a confusion of language that on one level is an act of divine judgment. And we're not going to go into the story of the Tower of Babel, but pay attention to some of the pictures that are taking place there in advance of that. The people are scattered everywhere. There had been a common speech and a common language, and there was effort on man's part, in essence, to continue to supplant the role of God. God was no longer their focus. They were making themselves their focus. Think about Romans chapters 1, 2, and 3. It's a very similar principle. But it's from those broken moments that God provides to them and to us something amazing. He foresees a series of attempts to accomplish this that are now coming into fruition. He scatters them. And then from that point there, the primal history of mankind, everything that leads up to the patriarchs, is portrayed as being unresolved, but God is now definitively identified that he is in charge. And with that, let me see if I can get there. We're going to see an arrival of these three promises. He's going to call Abram and Sarai and promise to them a series of future settings. With that picture, those stories are going to drive towards a pretty quick-to-catch perspective, because that promise will get repeated in Genesis 15 and Genesis 17. It's repeated one more time in Genesis 22. So that promise creates the framework for everything that happens next. And in that statement, let's break it down. The first thing we find is a promise, in essence, of a great nation. Now, that seems pretty obscure and odd at this point, because if you remember, Abram and Sarah, they don't really, or Sarai, who become Abram and Sarah, they don't really seem like parenting and nation-building types. They're of an advanced age. There are some brokenness in the relationships. As a side note, you might remember that God made this plan for them, and they continually tried to subvert the plan. God said, "This is what's going to happen." And they said, "Well, why don't we just pull a surrogate wife into this? That'll make everything better." If you remember in the story of the Bible from this point going forward, you could think about it this way. Every time man tries to solve this particular problem of a pledge through a family by bringing in extra relationships and extra people, it creates chaos and conflict. Every single time that pattern repeats itself from Abram all the way forward through the kings. But he tells Abraham, that he will become a great nation. And it sounds really wonderful until you read again that Sarah hadn't even had a child yet. Abraham is 75 years old. It doesn't seem like it's going to happen. And to our perspective, you think about how rare it would be to have a couple in their 70s deliver a live birth child. It's not like it's gotten, like, you know, like back then it was better and it's worse now. This is an incredibly impossible thing from the perspective of man, especially if we're forgetting about the divine picture that God is drawing for us. So right at the start of this story, we find that God is not going to act just through individuals, but he's telling us something else. It's not just Abraham and Sarah that matter. It's going to be a nation or a community. Individuals will be a big part of the story going forward, but we're immediately going to be shifting off of Abram and Sarah to be talking about Israel, talking about the descendants of David, and how Israel becomes us. Secondly, I think it's also important for us to recognize that God is shifting his focus too, from Adam or Adam, earth to man, to Abraham. The picture was very much one-on-one. But from Abraham to Moses, it's like God's focus shifts from the patriarch to the people. So the nation becomes important in this promise. But then there's a second one. There's a blessing. And so the second theme of this promise to Abraham and Sarah is framed in a repetitive concept of blessing. In this text alone, these two verses in the context of 3 and 4 in the overall picture, he says it 5 times. I'm blessing Abraham. Abraham's going to be a blessing. God will bless those who bless Abraham. And all the families on the earth will count themselves blessed through him. There's going to be a content to the covenant that's coming between God and Abraham and his people that's going to be abundantly different than everything else. Now, let me make a quick kind of pointer to tomorrow's lesson. This is so different than the religion of the ancient Near East. In Egypt, the way that the religious practice focused was very specific. For the common Egyptian, they had a list of rules of about 70, 72 things that they had to make sure that they kept perfectly in this life in order to catch the coattails of the Pharaoh to enter into the afterlife. Because everything in Egypt was going to be just about the Pharaoh. And if the Pharaoh didn't make it, they wouldn't make it. And just so we're clear, the Pharaoh's list was like 12 things. So he had a very low bar to make it. They had a very high bar to make it. And it was all dependent upon the Pharaoh being in the afterlife. And not just the Pharaoh, but everyone around him. That's why you have the massive tomb structures of the Great Pyramids of Giza. He wasn't buried alone. He was buried with his multiple wives. They're all given status, et cetera, et cetera. This is very different than how Jehovah is planning for the redemption of Israel. Everyone will eventually be on the same plane, and it's going to be a family thing or a community thing or a nation thing rather than a Moses thing, an Abraham thing, or a David thing. And that gradually opens itself up step by step in the story. So blessing them becomes our focus. And how is it that that's going to be coming through? Because what's this blessing to look like in contrast to what everyone would have known? Well, think about how this kind of opens itself or flowers in the text. Back in the Old Testament text of Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3, in creation, the same word of blessing is used 3 times on day 5, 6, and 7. Blessing there constituted fruitfulness, abundance, and fullness in the natural order. And then man is shown to be on the scene as part of God's good creation. Then as God bids Noah to set foot on this renewed or cleansed world after the flood, the language overflows again with this picture of blessing, multiplying and fulfilling all of God's promises. And in the rest of Genesis, that same creational attitude that connects with blessing repeats itself because of the Hebrew root barak that is used in the text. And so that's important for us to recognize as part of the good news of the promise to Abraham, because the gospel is good news. So this is a blessing to all of us. And you may notice a great tie-in to the New Testament. In Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 3, it reads, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places." So now the thread that went from Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 12:3. We've strung the telephone wires and the cups on the end all the way into the gospel, and we've attached ourselves to the blessings that are found in Christ, that God intends to bless his people and his nation. But there's one more promise that's made in this part of the text, and that's a promise of land. God had called Abraham out of the land of Babel, the great Mesopotamian empire. And salvation was not going to come to land through those human empires, those powerful people. God tells Abraham to go to a land where he will show him. It turns out to be the land of Canaan. And Abraham himself remains a temporary resident there. He moves around in what would be a semi-nomadic lifestyle. At one point, he buys a grave site. Now, I want to point out why that's important. It's something that you may not catch on an initial reading of the text, but maybe we can pay attention to it right now. From Genesis going to Jesus, there is a perception of the afterlife or heaven, which is slowly revealed in the text. And generally speaking, in the Old Testament particularly, you can see heaven or afterlife or what comes beyond described with terms like this, going to the fathers. I'm going to be with my fathers. There is a lineage aspect to heaven that's deeply rooted in their understanding of what it meant to be who they were. They were going to go to their fathers. They were going to be there too. And so this family relationship was one of the highest important aspects of whom they were. And so by Abram buying a place to where he will then be buried and Sarah will then be buried, he's rooting himself to the spiritual future of the land, because he is setting the stage for everyone else to follow through that into whatever heaven would be for them. And as time goes on, you'll notice in the Psalms, you'll notice in the writings of David, you'll notice in the work of the prophets, that they take that theme of heaven being going to the fathers, and God gradually opens the door to help us see what Jesus then personifies in the Gospels, where he tells us what it's like. And if you remember, in the very small illustrations that Jesus pulls from the majestic chaos and the majestic cosmos of the heavens to say this is what it's like, almost exclusively it shows us a patriarchal picture, because it ties it all together, because it's not about the people, it's about the family. And that's the term that they were using. And so he's tying them to the family of God who laid an anchor in the land of Canaan before Israel was an Israel. God himself then gives great reasons for why that land is so significant. When the promise is renewed in Genesis 15, there's going to be return to that land. There's going to be some other aspects of that will be identified. Even at that point, and this is that tie-in. Remember I mentioned early in the lesson that the land itself was cursed and there was a consequential guilt on the land? That area where Abram was called to go to, where Abraham went to, before the Israelites conquered it in the half-conquest of Joshua and then the final conquests of David, was steeped in what we would consider idolatry, depravity, and immorality. At some of the key historic sites in Israel, some of the deepest foundational archaeological evidence shows something pretty significant. And in that significant setting, you see altars designed for sacrifice, altars designed for abuse. And when Israel comes in, their command from God is to wipe all that clean, to cleanse the land, to make it holy. And so that's one of the reasons that God has in store for the conquest of Canaan, to set up an opportunity for holiness to exist and to tie those thread together. It's that holy land that was promised to Abraham, and that holy nation that was promised through Abraham, and that holy seed that was promised to Adam through Abraham, through Boaz, through David, to Jesus, that would bring about the blessing to you and I. The gift of the land then is really a core element of that promise. And that story drives every single thing that happens after it. Those three promises. But those three promises are going to build into something even greater because there's one story. And you say, wait a minute, the Bible's not one story because there's like 66 books, 20 plus authors. Sometimes I get lost in the Kings, Chronicles, and Samuel. And here's another way to think about it, by the way. If you ever like me and get lost, and I get lost in the Bible both intentionally and unintentionally often, here's a quick thing to think about. We talked last night of how Judges is a spiral downward and Ruth is the changing of the script where things go from awful to amazing very quickly. When you go into Samuel's and Chronicles and Kings, they serve different purposes. Samuel is really about telling that, at least on one level, the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, that God is king and you don't need anyone else, but everyone acts like they need a king. And then when they get a king, 1 and 2 Kings, we see how bad that is. And then 1 and 2 Chronicles, which in some ways is like David's greatest achievements, is telling us to look for a better king. Well, David was good, a better king is coming. And they serve those bigger purposes because they're all part of one particular story, and it's a story that supersedes the small little tidbits of David, Solomon, and all the others we might think of. Because those promises build us towards something really amazing. The people. You see, the story of God is in part about that long narrative pushing forward that God is going to keep his promise, firstly, through the people we then meet. It tells the story of how God begins to fill that first promise up to the brim. And he instructs Abraham to learn to trust by asking him to do what we would consider improbable, impossible, implausible for any of us, to sacrifice the child of promise. Isaac is spared because God provides. The story goes forward and we see Esau and Jacob. Great rivalry, but then they're reconciled. Jacob's own family falls into a more prolonged feuding over Joseph, and Joseph is about as tragic as they come. Sometimes we look at Joseph and we go, what's going on there? Because what Joseph does is he descends into behavior that's just like the Egyptians. When his brothers find him, he's dressing like an Egyptian. He's holding the diviner's cup like an Egyptian priest would do, and he is invisible to his own family. It is his brother's grace and compassion that brings him back out. And so that story is as much about the redemption of Joseph as it is the redemption of Judah, because it is the redemption of Israel that foretells the redemption of us. And that story then moves into the next great blessing, because the blessing of Israel is pretty amazing as well. You think about what's going to happen for them in Exodus, Leviticus, and then that first part of Numbers as it goes forward. Israel's in slavery, and they've gone from the highways to the lowest way. They were given the blessed area to raise their cattle, and they were thrown every benefit from the Pharaoh and from what God was doing through them and for them. But then another king, another Pharaoh rose up, and their story shifted to slavery because they were going to be used as a tool to move the story forward. They were forged into a nation. Their wealth grew abundantly. Their numbers grew at such a surprising rate that the nation that enslaved them became terrified of them. You think about that for a second. These were farmers with no skill in war, but their simple numbers made them terrified. And God's bringing an answer to that blessing. The relationship is then established that they are the people that God promised. You notice in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 7, the scriptures read, but the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. And so two of those promises in our one story have been fulfilled, but now we begin to see the next steps. All the events and teachings between Exodus 19 and Numbers 9, they take place around Mount Sinai. But Numbers 10, God is telling Israel to go forward. Now, picture that moment, if you can, for a second. Some of us may have seen any number of rah-rah type movies where there's big crowds excited for the next thing to happen and everyone's cheering. Well, in many ways, Numbers 9 and 10 is just that. You have the heads of the tribes gathered to the fore, declaring the numbers that are with them, and their massive people of Israel are about to move out and go forward, and they chicken out. They get terrified because they get to the edge of the promised land, and I have described it for myself this way. They bounce off the edge. It's right there. And I encourage you to do this. You may not have the ability to travel to Israel, but I'll tell you, sitting from a likely spot where Moses spied into the promised land is awe-inspiring. And with technology, just like Zoom, you can do that too. You can actually go to Google Maps and kind of position to the state park that looks into Israel and looks into the promised land. And you say, well, it may have been here, if not here, somewhere nearby. And you see the very thing that they bounced off of. And it's majestic and it's wonderful. And yet they wouldn't take hold of it. Their great fear kept them from receiving the land that was promised to them, but their descendants would. Because they're all angling from this text. I will bless those who will bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. In that text, God actually has a greater goal than just getting Israel to the land. The goal that's there, the bottom line, the very biggest thing that matters the most is not just in that climax of opportunity. See, when God spoke to Abraham in Genesis 12, God's eyes are actually past Abraham. He's looking beyond him to a promise that the nation one day will provide the seed we need to redeem the world. Because his ultimate purpose is to bring blessing, not just to Israel, but to all nations on the earth. The verse is very particular here in the way that it's rendered, through you. But its goal is dramatically universal. All the peoples on the earth. I will suggest to you now, since we've built the slingshot, that sentence is the trigger for the rest of the Bible story. And it's an astonishing one at that. God is talking to one old man and an elderly wife who is but unable to have any children. And he tells him that he will be the means by which God's blessing is going to be brought to all the families, all the people on the entire planet. And don't think about that last line, that little clause, a few other folks will be blessed too, as a secondary thing. It actually is the thing. And that's why it gets repeated five times in Genesis, three to Abraham, once to Isaac, once to Jacob. It's the foundation of the story that is to come. And it launches itself into God's mission to redeem mankind, to rebuild the relationship that exists between that earth and heaven that was found in the middle space of the garden. So earthly people like you and me who have had life breathed into us can one day again coexist with God who supersedes us by the majestic nature of who he is, because it's a global gospel. It's for everybody. When he says all nations, it's good news. Because think about our world right now. How divided are we no matter where we live? We've got brethren who are with us from the Philippines, who at times, and I've been to the Philippines myself, it's been a few years. In your nation is just like ours. We get divided and broken about so many things. Stuff that really doesn't matter. Because in the end, all of this fades. There is a kingdom that is so much greater than the kingdom that our eyes can see. And there is a relationship that is so much stronger than any of the boundaries on a map can provide. Abraham, Sarah, and the nation that flowed from them is that great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language that, by the way, is hinted at in the closing part of the Bible in Revelation chapter 7 and verse 9. That covenant of Abraham triggers it all off. And it's true then for us to think about the people of Israel in the Old Testament as to be the foundation for you and I to achieve that goal. But how is it so often that we end up being more like them than we plan to be? Because you remember this. When Jesus walked the earth, he had to use a despised Samaritan to teach the Jewish nation what it meant to be compassionate. He had to use the one they hated to teach them what it was like to love. Here are a couple of Psalms that I think are really important for us if we want to make application of God's desire to have that creation, that Barak idea of blessing come true for all of us. There are three Psalms, Psalm 22, Psalm 47, and Psalm 86. Don't turn to them. I'm going to read them. So you'll be able to keep up that way. You can turn to them later. Psalm 22, verse 27 reads this way. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. The psalmist also writes, Psalm 47, verse 9, the nobles of the nations assemble as the people of the God of Abraham. For the kings of the earth belong to God. He is greatly excited. And Psalm 86, verse 9, all the nations you have made will come and worship before you, Lord. They will bring glory to your name. As we began the lesson tonight, I asked you to try to pretend to do something. Pretend that you were sitting on the banks of the Jordan River and your grandfather was telling you a story of Israel. He's telling you about Abraham. And maybe he got excited and maybe he chased a few rabbits. But in the course of that, do you ever wonder, because I do this, how the average Israelite, maybe singing those songs, conceived a world that superseded their ability to see past the horizon of their life? But they sing them anyway. They sing the song of Israel's gospel, advanced through Abraham, a good news of a covenant and a commitment that blesses everybody. You and I might be freaking out. I'll speak specifically to the Americans about which of the two fools will be in the office of the president in a few days, months. Because really, that's our choice. Fool number A or fool number B. And if you disagree with me, awesome. My king is Jesus, and he's no fool, and I'm trying not to be like the world and more like him. You see, it's no wonder that the Apostle Paul then calls this verse in Genesis 12 and verse 3, in simplified terms, in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 8, the gospel in advance. It's the future gospel. Because there's a good news that supersedes all the stress of this life. Abraham was the trigger that set it off, and he fulfilled it. He fulfilled his part. Oh, and by the way, Jesus came too. Paul doesn't use Abraham as just an illustration of the gospel. He is the beginning of the gospel. And the God of Abraham, Yahweh, declares that the people of Israel, as they would come to be known, God is going to use them to deal with the sins of mankind. And the ultimate goal and the ultimate plan of that blessing came to fruition in Jesus, a chosen people. The global goal of blessing all the nations is still on the table for us. The gospel can spread all the way around and come back again. And one day it may be that brethren from the Philippines start sending preachers to the U.S. to fix the mess that we've made. And there's a connection between that and us that is universal and timeless. This world will one day fade away, but God's pledge and promise of heaven is for all of us, and through Jesus we can find redemption. We're going to look at the rest of the Old Testament going forward in a couple more nights, and it's going to show how God, through the law and the prophets, keeps calling Israel back to that high commitment to be a light to the nations, and unfortunately how Israel fails, and how God calls us to be a light to the nations, a city set upon a hill, a light set on the stand, so that they can see Jesus and him crucified, and more importantly, him risen.